Welcome, everybody, to this episode of the Growth Focus Podcast, where I bring tech leaders and business leaders from all around the world to share their insights and their expertise. Today, we have the honor of having Michael Petra from here, and we're going to be talking all things from startup, from coding onto floppy disks, through to major enterprises, insights, and mindset for the CEO, and much, much more. My name is Gary Lafferty, your host and CEO and focus of the Growth Focus Partnerships, where we help founders of tech build their business and become authorities within their niche. So without further ado, Michael, let's bring you in. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here today. Why don't you start off with giving us a little snippet of how you got started, give us a little bit of introduction, and where you are today.
Okay, I'll try to fit it all into the available time. Thank you, Gary. My name is Michael Petra. I'm a director at Evo. It's one of my hats that I wear. And I guess I got started, almost 100 years ago now. I did my computer science degree in school, and I went to London. And my first job was straight out of college, and I worked for a company, a small software company, developing international banking software. And I was there for about 2 years, and I enjoyed it, but I felt that I was working for the man. And that really wasn't how I saw myself. So I wanted to be the man. So I actually resigned very quickly after those first 2 years and set up my own show and approached my dad. At the time, I think I was 22 or 21, something like that. And I said, Dad, I've got this idea. I want to start my own company. And he gave me £5,000. With that £5,000, I took out an ad in the Yellow Pages. That's back in the day when we had books and we had to look stuff up in books. We didn't actually have the internet.
I don't think anybody under the age of 30 even knows what that is, Michael, really, do they?
So this is going way back. This is when you really had to work hard and actually go to a job. So I took an ad out, and my first client was British Gas. And the way this started was they came to me and they said that they needed a system to help them do their purchasing, operate, their purchases and buy stuff from their vendors and manage the flow through of their procurement. So I went off and I built a very simple software system, and they bought it. And so I was off and running. It was awful. It was written in Pascal, I think, which was an archaic kind of language. But it went from there, and you only need one good client. And from that, you leverage that and you start advertising that you've got that client, and then other people come. So this is back in the 80s, when we were lucky just to have a fax machine. But eventually, the internet comes along. And in I think it was 1996, I registered my first domain. We then threw up a website, and it was very old tech. But I realized that the way that you make money in software is not by single sales, it's by recurring revenue. And then I had to think about, how can I enforce my clients wanting to pay each year for using my software? And this is going back into the days of DOS, when we didn't have encryption codes, etc. But they did have dongles. And a dongle literally is a physical device that you plug into the back of your computer. And so we would sell the serial number for the dongle every year, and that activated the software. So it was kind of forcing people to pay for us. And we had recurring revenue before recurring revenue was a thing. And that was a wonderful thing. That is the golden, that's the golden cow, really. That's what keeps, churning out the cash. Because what it did for me, obviously, everybody knows there's business goes in cycles, there's up cycles, there's down cycles, up and down. When you have a client that is paying you no matter what, that balances out the dips. So we didn't go out of business, we stayed in business. And fast forward to sort of the early 2000s, when the internet starts to come really important, and people now have email and people are throwing up kind of websites to try to do applications. Salesforce came out with their own application, and that was a real eye-opener for me. I thought, why can't we copy what the Salesforce people are doing? So we started building web-based apps with our procurement solution. And the problem there was that people didn't believe in the security of websites. No companies wanted to put their data in the public domain. That was a big battle, and we got through that, and we eventually got to the point where we were developing our own code, we were hosting our own servers. We had a team both in London and in India who were developing code for us, and they were my own staff. I wasn't contracting it out. I like to have control of the whole machine. And then we started putting in some sales and marketing people, and before you know it, you have a functioning business. And so my role, really, I was now stepping back from actually doing the coding, because in the early days, I was actually literally sitting down writing code. And I had my hands on the gears and the wheels of the business as well, managing the company, managing the staff, managing the development, managing the strategy, and meeting client expectations and attending meetings, physically attending meetings. There was no Zoom. I actually had to literally go around to companies with 5-inch floppy disks and stick them in their machines and install them and then train them physically. And then the 5 inches became 3.5 inches, and then it became deliverable over the internet. And so that's where we are now. Obviously, you know, everything's done remotely. This meeting is being done remotely, and all of our meetings are done remotely. And it's a massive time save. And what that means, it's a massive cost lower. You know, the delta between what you're making and what you're spending is the profit area. So it's not just about making sales, it's about lowering costs and becoming efficient. So we found efficiencies in that little business that made us profitable. We reinvested those profits back into training our team, widening our scope, widening our business, and now we're operating 24/7 around the globe, you know, with clients all over the place. The problem for me personally was that the business was almost running itself at this point. I had people in the business that were managing the teams, managing the sales and marketing. And so me personally, I wasn't very busy. And so I wanted to get into something else. I didn't just want to sit there playing with model airplanes all day long. I actually wanted to do something functional. So I tried to expand my business scope, and I started dabbling in other areas, not just software. I mean, I am a software guy at heart, my degree's in software. But you know, it was more sort of a practical approach into business. I didn't go to business school, I didn't take an MBA, but I know how to add up, and I know how to talk to people. And I thought I'd try to merge the few skills that I had and put them in different areas. So that led me to my next phase in business, as it were. I still run this company, and I'm still managing the business, but now I'm doing several other things as well. I was approached by a close friend of mine in New York to start a new business. And so his idea was to get into the cannabis space. And this was about 7 years ago. So we joined together, and we got a third person involved who was a scientist, and we created a medication to help people who are suffering from concussion. We partnered with Miami University. We partnered with a boutique investment bank in New York. We ended up going public, and we were listed on the Canadian Stock Exchange, which was kind of fun. And we also had an international listing on the NASDAQ. So I actually, my claim to fame is that I pushed the button on the NASDAQ with my partner, and I had my picture all over Times Square. So that was kind of fun. And that business did quite well. We exited from that company about 4.5 years now. And then I'm twiddling my thumbs again. Well, now what? What's my next thing? I still had the software company, so I'm still, you know, spending 20% of my time on the software company. But again, I had 80% of my time, I still needed to do something. So I said to my friend, I said, look, let's do it again, but let's focus on a more modern version, like psilocybin, which is a psychedelic drug to help people who are suffering from PTSD. So the military were interested in that. And that also became a public company, listed in Canada. Again, it's a little dodgy listing these kinds of things in the United States, because they're not thought of as completely legal ways of treating people. But in Canada, it was looked at a little kindly. So we span up another company in the psilocybin space. I was on that board for 3.5 years. And it was giving me public board experience, which is very much fun, because you're playing with other people's money and making kind of cool decisions. So that was fun. And I exited off that board just this July because I wanted to focus on our third startup that we were working on, which was in the cultivated meat space. And that business is just been given its ticker symbol to go public on the Canadian Stock Exchange. I just got the ticker symbol last week for that. So that's my next public endeavor. And I'm excited about where that's going to lead. Now, I'm not the scientist. I don't know anything about, well, I know very little about cannabis, about psilocybin, about, you know, cultivated meat. And for those of you that do not know what cultivated meat is, of course, you can Google it. But very quickly, what it is we're taking the cells from the cow and we're putting them in a petri dish, basically, and growing a steak. I mean, it's a little more complex than that, but that's my layman version of it. And so it's sustainable for the planet. And I think, you know, one of the things that drives me is being involved in businesses that do good and also create something from nothing. I didn't want to be, with the greatest respect to anybody that's watching this, I didn't want to be a real estate agent or a car salesperson. I wanted to actually create something and have control from start to finish of the whole process and the whole product. And I think my clients, when I'm speaking to the people that are buying these products, they have a higher level of trust in you when they know that you've literally been involved from the beginning to the end. Not only do you know the business, but you know the product and you know how to relate to the clients as well. And so that really takes me to where I am today, which is, there's one other thing I'm working with, which is I got a startup in Los Angeles, which is in the grocery business, which is a very exciting concept. In fact, it is the one that excites me the most because I think that's going to move the needle for the general public. That business is, the aim of that business is to save consumers 30% on their grocery bills. And, you know, we've just gone through an election cycle here in the United States. And the most common question that the presidential candidates were asked is, how can we save, what are you going to do about the grocery bills? You know, they've gone sky high. Ever since COVID, they've just gone like that. And so everybody's suffering. I mean, I've noticed my bills have gone up. I'm a single dad. I buy groceries for my children every week. And the bills have gone up by a large factor. So I can only imagine what other people are feeling. So we feel that in my team on this business, we feel that this is going to really move the needle for the better and try to implement savings for people that are really going to be felt in their pockets. So that's what I go back to again, is just doing stuff for good, because I think that what goes around comes around, and I think you get a benefit from that.
Yeah, well, that's a fascinating, amazing story, Michael, from, you know, just getting out there, and you managed to cram an awful lot in those few short minutes. What I think, and the variety of it as well, I think that's when some listeners are going to be thinking, wow, it's not just the one-trick pony, as we used to call it back in London. You know, you've got a variety there. But wanted to dial this back again, because there's going to be people here listening who are on different rungs of their career ladder, of their business ladder. And although we're hearing things like MRR now, you know, monthly recurring income, back in the day when you started that really wasn't a thing. It wasn't a hip word. So that, if it's not a hip word, it means it's not really known out there in the marketplace. So even though you saw that and you thought this is a great way to build residual income, it makes sense in your head. But what kind of issues did you come across with the marketplace, who were suddenly thinking, well, what do you mean I've got to continually pay for this?
They hated it.
How did you get past that?
They hated it. They absolutely hated it. So the other way of doing it is you come up with a product. And in the software game, that software product has got to be developed initially. So I pay the bill to get it developed. But it's also got to be supported. You can't just sell one thing to somebody. They have the product and it's a complex product that needs, you know, tweaking occasionally and training on. And then you disappear off into the sunset with their money. It comes down to customer service and the high level of customer service to keep retention. That's the important thing. You want customers to keep coming back. It's no good just one and done. You're not going to make any money with a one and done approach. So one of the cultures, I mean, a business fails or succeeds by its culture. And that has to be set from the top. So one of the things that I was very enthusiastic about is high level of customer service. And if you look at, I mean, don't just take my word for it. You look at the online reviews for Evo and you'll see they're very good. The reason they're very good is because we prioritize our existing customers over any new customers. And so part of the tactic of onboarding a new client is to say, yes, not only are we selling you this thing, but if you pay us each year a proportion of what it's going to cost. So we were charging 20% a year for the actual product support. You're not just getting support, but you're getting a high level of customer service, which is better than the other guy. And when you are shopping for a new vendor, when you're shopping for a software, today, it's very easy to do. You type into Google, you get a whole bunch of things come up. But in those days, it wasn't quite as accessible. But we still had to look good compared to our competitors. And we just sold it and we kept the recurring revenue coming by delighting our clients. And so I have a little phrase, which is, you know, my objective when I put my salesman's hat on is to have happy customers with waggy tails and smiley faces. And that's really important because happy customer begets another happy customer. And I can illustrate that in numerous ways. You make a product sale to a customer in a big company. They're happy, you're happy. But it's a dynamic thing. It's constantly evolving and changing. The customer that you've sold that to, the person that you've sold that to, may one day up and leave that business and go to another business and want to take you with them. So you've made that sale over there. That customer's now jumped ship, or the person that you were dealing with has jumped ship to a different business, and he wants to bring you in. And that's happened repeatedly, numerous times. I 20 or 30 times it's happened in my business career. So it's a kind of an exponential growth. So if you're keeping your customers super happy, they'll remember that, they'll value that, and they'll take you with them when they move, because everybody moves.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant piece of advice, because people do move within their careers. Yeah. And, you know, if they can take you with them into their new enterprise, into their thing, that's a sale that you don't actually now have to go out and get. The sale's already there, which leads me to something that we talked about off camera. And this is a bit controversial, and this is why I think you and I could talk about this, is that there's going to be people out here who are listening who are in their business and they're struggling to either build trust out there or get across the line with their sales. And one of the things that you and I talked about off camera before was you fake it till you make it. Yeah. You've got to have that complete belief behind you to go ahead. So let's talk, because it's fake it till you make it is normally given one of those negative connotations to it. But actually, if it's done right, there's a very good positive way of doing things. Let's share some insights on that, Michael.
So as an example, I can tell you this now because it was an old story and I'm not going to get into trouble. But as an example, in my cannabis business, we had come up with this drug, the idea for a drug, and we needed to have a clinical trial partner to test the drug was safe and ethically okay. We teamed up with a large university who shall remain nameless, who said to us, we would love to do the clinical trial for you, but we need to have $20 million in the bank. Before in your bank so that we know we're going to get paid. And we said, okay, no problem. Of course, we had about $5 in the bank at the time. But the thing is, you've got to look confident, right? You don't start panicking in front of the client. That's the number one thing you don't want to do. I then get onto my friend who's connected up in Wall Street, who we were doing this business with. I was in partnership with him. And I said, look, Jonathan, we need to find $20 million. Otherwise, the university aren't going to sign with us. He goes, okay, I'll make some calls. He made some calls. He found a boutique investment bank. They said they'll give us the money, or they'll give us some money to start, but they need a signed contract from the university before they give us the money. So they know there's a real business. So that was a problem. It's what we call the catch-22 situation. I couldn't move forward with either one because everybody wanted something else from somebody else. So what did I do? Well, I was a bit naughty. I knew if they cooperated through us, we would make it work. But I had to fake it. So what did I do? I came up with a bank statement. I designed a bank statement which showed X number of dollars in the bank. I showed it to the university. They said, all right, that's fine. That looks good. We'll sign the contract. I signed the contract. We took the contract to the bank. The bank looked at it and said, terrific. Here's some money. Long story short, it ended up to be a $120 million business. So that's how you do it. Now, in the current space, current way I work, it's not quite like that. That's a little footloose and fancy free. Now I'm a bit more of a grown up businessman, and I wouldn't quite do that now. But there are times when you have customers or clients that come along and say, "Look, Michael, we really want this, And what it's a real reach, it's a real stretch, and you can't just snap your fingers and produce it. But what you do is you say, hey, that's no problem. I know this space very well. I guarantee you that we will get this done, and have faith. And, you know, to show faith, don't even pay me yet. Pay me when you get it. The point is that you're building trust because they've got a history with you in terms of an existing customer. If it's not an existing customer, the best thing you can do is to fall back on your existing customers to use them as a reference site for your new customers. So we've had to jump through all so many hoops with new customers. I mean, we take on law firms, we take on banks, they're government clients that we have. They don't just place business with you. They want to know. They want to look at you with a microscope and look up every orifice you have to make sure that you're legit. So I say, look, I just go talk to our existing customers. Just they'll vouch for me. They've got no reason to lie or to hoodwink you. But if they're happy, would you agree to sign with us? And that's the best form of reference you can have. I mean, you know, there's all kinds in the software world. There's all kinds of regulations that you know have to comply with. There's lots of privacy controls and compliance controls. You can't really short circuit that stuff. You've still got to go through the hoops. But you do need to get people's trust. When you have their trust and they believe you and you're a product champion for your own product, the sky's the limit.
And that really is a good, great combination there. As you said, you know, you got to have your good clients, which leads back to what you started with right at the very beginning, right? Is we want to have good customers, happy waggy tail customers from the start. And if you see that as a long-term thing, as opposed to a short-term gain, you can now start utilizing them and using them and their goodwill to build your business. So this leads me nicely into the next thing about having multiple plans, plan A, plan B, plan C. And we all know as entrepreneurs, we've heard that phrase before, be all in or be out. You know, you're either in or you're out, you gotta go in. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't have other plans, plan B and plan C and plan B. Let's talk a little bit about that, Michael.
Well, I speak to this as an individual, right? So I'm a busy guy. I have three children. I'm a single dad. And I want to provide security for my family. So having an A plan and a B plan and a C plan, they're fallbacks in case things go wrong with plan A. So I focus on numerous solutions. I'm a strategic thinker, but I'm also an out-of-the-box planner. So I'm always coming up with whenever there's a business problem that I have to resolve, you know, you have to laterally think, this is the way I think it should be done. But in case that doesn't work, there's a backup plan here that I can fall back on, which may not be as effective as plan A, but will get the job done. It might be a more circuitous route to get there, and it might perhaps cost a little more, but I will get there in the end. That's really how I've always managed to move my life forward. I mean, it's not just a business thing. It's also a personal thing. For example, I'm living in California. We're in an earthquake zone. So my backup plan for my earthquake is that I've got a go bag over here. God forbid the house falls down and buries the go bag. Well, I got another one secreted somewhere else in a separate space. It's very much like having software backups. You know, you're taught when you're backing up your software, not just to back it up on a single disk and stick it in the drive, in your safe, but to have one over here, have one over there, have one over here. So I've got these little thumb drives, I've got actual hard drives, I've also got my hard drive on my computer, and I back it up into the cloud, a cloud that I own. It's my own cloud. I don't put it onto, you know, public clouds. So that's an illustrative example of just making sure, God forbid, plan A fails, you've got B, C, and D.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. And it's almost like drinking your own Kool-Aid, isn't it? You're out there, especially the guys out there in tech listening to this. They like you say, they already know you must have backups. You must have multiple backups for safety, but they tend to do that with their own companies. They're just all in or nothing. So I think it's a really, we're not saying don't be all in. It's just that be all in, but just in case there are backups up there around so that you can hook back into that when necessary, if necessary.
There's one other point I would just briefly make. Any good company is all centered around its people. It's not just about the product, it's about the people. So you need backup plans in place with the staff that you have, the team that you have. So I have a really good team behind me, and it's structured in a sort of a waterfall method. I'm at the top of the tree, there's a couple of people underneath me, there's a couple of people, and then it sort of falls down. Any one or a group of two or three should be able to do what I do. So God forbid I'm dead tomorrow, the business will still succeed. And it's that kind of a backup plan. It's like almost like a succession plan you must have in place for your business. It's not just about one person. Your customers would never want to place business with you if it was all about me. And it isn't. I'm the front face of the Evo company. And it's the business that I started. So I'm the founder. So that's the way it should be. But I've got a very good professional team who are dedicated to what they're doing. And they're motivated. They're paid correctly. And they're working in the latest tools. And they're implementing all kinds of cool stuff, which gets them excited.
Yeah, that, I wish I had more time to talk about that, because obviously that's a whole new topic that we can dive deep into. Succession plans, like you said, the company is worth far more if it's not dependent completely on you, if somebody wanted to buy it or you wanted to scale it or even, you know, realize its enterprise value. And I think a lot of founders forget that and think, well, I am the baby, I am the thing. But if you're not successful, then you're worth far less.
No, that's very important.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you know, what I've built is an asset. I don't want to do it for the rest of my life. I want to go sit on a beach at some point. But, you know, when I get to retirement, which might be in the next 3 to 4 years, I want to pass off the asset as a successful business where I can step out or step away and it's still going to function as it should. So that's something that everybody should keep in mind.
So let's talk about this lifestyle. Let's talk about you intentionally built a lifestyle business, you know, but it was a far cry from when you first started in London. When you started in London, you're getting out there, you're knocking on doors, getting that first client. When did you decide that, do you know what, I don't want to have this nose to the grind every single day. I have an intention to build a lifestyle business. So I'm going to build the business around me now, as opposed to me around that business.
That was a big, important change for me personally. So yes, I was in London. I was working my nuts off, quite frankly, driving in rush hour traffic from Northwest London all the way out to the East End and back again. And it was a nightmare. It took me like 3-4 hours to get backwards and forwards. So I got divorced. And my divorce was a bit of a sea change to me. I thought, you know, I can't work like this forever. This is too hard. So I moved. I moved to Florida. And it was sunshine and it was sea and it was sand and it was pretty and it was just wonderful. And I got myself a beautiful apartment and this was when I started to work remotely. It was possible in those days. This is now the early 2000s. And I was sitting on a beach with wasn't an iPhone, but it was the equivalent of in those days. And shooting emails backwards and forwards. I think it was a BlackBerry at the time. And I was still in touch and I was still managing to negotiate deals and I was still maintaining a team in London and in India and managing the two. And I wasn't actually doing very much work. So I was out having fun and still felt very dialed in. And this, I loved it. I mean, who wouldn't love that? I mean, I was working remotely before working remotely was a thing. And so since those days, for the last 25 years, I've been, you know, working remotely and enjoying my time, because that motivates you. If you have your nose to the grindstone all the time, then you're never going to be able to have time to sit up and look around and enjoy your life. I wanted to be one of those dads that did have time with my kids, that did know who I was. And I wanted to go to the ballet recitals. I wanted to go to the singing competitions and I wanted to be very present. Life is about balance. A successful life is about balance. It can't all be just work and no play. I mean, I grew up with my dad and my mom, who are still alive and married together, fortunately. My dad was a pharmacist and used to go to his job at like 7 a.m. in the morning, 7 days a week, and come home 7 p.m. That taught me not to have that. I did not want that. That was hard work. I wanted to be, you know, they use the term work smart, not hard. That's been one of my mantras. So try to be super efficient with your time, Be kind to everybody that comes across your path. A lecturer at my university once said to me, Michael, there's an important lesson in life I'd like to tell you is, on your rise up the ladder of success, be nice to everybody because you're going to meet them on the way down. And that stuck with me. So I think, being kind, respectful, efficient and professional are some of the takeaways that I would impact you on this podcast, because I think that is an investment in your future and in your kids' futures. The optics have to be that you're efficient at work, but you're being nice about it as well. You don't have to be a hard ass and be mean. That's just not necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, again, one of the fascinating things that I've always employed into my businesses and things like that and my clients is that, again, if you look for the long term, say, right, that at some point I want to exit this as an enterprise, I want to do this, I want to exit, the sooner you start making sure that you are building yourself out of that business, so you're not doing the 12, 14, 15 hour, 18 hour days, the sooner you put your SOPs in place, the better it's going to be and the easier it actually is going to be. So I do quite rightly say, you begin to enjoy life with or without your family or whatever you wish to do.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we're all going to die at some point. At the point when I'm dying and I want to look back at my life and I think, I did it right. I raised 3 kids. I've got great relationships with both ex-wives. It's just moving through life with style and ease, but not dropping the ball and still being able to juggle all these different things. Yeah, I mean, I've got 3 businesses I'm involved in at the moment, I enjoy every one of them for different reasons.
Right. So I've always got a loaded question, Michael. I mean, thank you so much for sharing all those insights so far. But before I let you go, I've got one more loaded question for you. And I always want to ask a guest this loaded question. And with you particularly, for someone who has had so much success at both ends, from startup knocking on doors, trying to find that first client, to public companies, to running that and hitting the button on the NASDAQ, to going back to startups again, this yo-yo of going and starting and growing and going and starting and growing. My question to you is this: how do you define success now compared to when you first started?
Happiness. That's it. I mean, that's the one word I would say. I'm very happy. Thank God I've still got my health. And I get up every morning not knowing what to expect, but with a smile on my face. And I think, as I said, it goes back to balance. I mean, yes, I am firing in all different directions. I mean, this is the 5th phone call or 5th meeting I've had today. Each one has been different, but each one is stimulating in a different way. So I sleep pretty good at night, right? I'm exhausted, but I'm also elated because I'm producing stuff. I'm producing things in this business, in this business, in this. I love my children. And that's also very important to me. My family connections are very important. My friend connections are very important. My business connections are very important. And it's all about balancing the whole lot, which equals happiness. That's the formula. All this stuff on the left-hand side of the equation, you got the equal sign and you got the happiness. That's
awesome. Awesome. That's a great way to end this. Michael, thank you very much for joining us. If people want to get hold of you, perhaps talk about potential business product or a thing, what's the best way of getting hold of you?
I'm on LinkedIn. Reach out on LinkedIn. I'm very easily found. Or you can just shoot me an email, mike@evo.com, EYVO.com. And I'll be happy to chat.
Brilliant. Well, I'll make sure I put those links in the show notes. So if people want to kick a hold of you on LinkedIn or your email, they can go straight to you. So thank you very much, Michael, for sharing your insights and your expertise. It's been an absolute pleasure having you. I wish we could talk longer on this, and perhaps we'll have a part two at some stage. But thank you very much, as I said, for having it. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on our episode today. And if you have got any insights, you've taken any insights or advice or something I did ideas that you've got from Michael, please make sure you do one of four or all four things, which is make sure you leave a comment, make sure you like, and make sure you subscribe. But more importantly, make sure you share. Who do you know that could also benefit from the insights that Michael has shared for us? So make sure you share so that more people within business and within industry can grow. So until next time, Michael, again, thank you for joining us and being such a great guest. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us. Until next time, take care. We'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.